speaking in our proceedings, I'd just like to, one, thank Court here and Chief Judge Barbara Lynn and Clerk Karen Mitchell and the entire staff for being so accommodating to us through this whole process. And I'm also, a real treat for me, the best thing I do every year is judge the high school moot court competition for the Brennan Marshall Constitutional Law Project. And we understand that the Texas mock trial team from East Dallas, Bishop Lynch High School, is here today to observe. So why don't you stand so we can all recognize you? Well, welcome. We're thrilled to have you. For better or for worse, we're doing patent law this morning. But you may be seated, but thank you for attending. First case this morning is 18-2008, Evolved Wireless versus ZTE. Mr. Schultz, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court.
One housekeeping question.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree claim one is illustrative?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue in this case is that because there is no disclosure in the references relied upon by the board and the appellees, the board improperly and without support expanded the disclosures that were cited by the appellees in support of their decisions.
Let me start off by, we've got a threshold claim construction issue, and I understand in this case it's not an issue because the board agreed with your claim construction. Right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So on the legal question, de novo review, you prevailed.
That's
so
correct.
Is there anything that we're going to hear about this morning that isn't reviewed by us under substantial evidence?
Not from us, Your Honor. No. So it's important to keep in mind what the invention is of the 236 patent. The 236 patent invention is about sending the right data at the right time. And it does that by...
You argue that in contrast to prior... 236 discloses, I'm sort of quoting you more or less, transmission of the stored message tree buffer data only when a random access response uplink grant is received in a random access procedure. But very shortly after technical spec 321 was released, the three GPP members independently, says the record, submitted within 3 hours of each other nearly identical proposals to clarify the technical spec 321 requiring that the user equipment receive a random access response uplink grant before transmitting the correct third message in a random access procedure. How's that not evidence of simultaneous development?
Right. Great question, Your Honor. So a couple points. One, there's nothing in the record that it was independent. Okay, LG came first, Qualcomm came second.
Yeah, that's why I said that the way I did, yeah.
And it's important to keep in mind how this process works with the standard of setting development. First of all, their burden to show was independent invention. All they just said was, Qualcomm comes a little later, Qualcomm's a different company, therefore must be independent. That's not enough. The way these standard setting processes work is there's a lot of communication behind the scenes.
It's groupthink.
And they're trying to build consensus. So it's not surprising that all of a sudden two companies say this is the way to go because that's how you change the standard. And I think what's important to keep in mind, too, is there was a change. The prior art specification for 321 that the petitioners, the appellees and the board relied on was changed to reflect the claimed invention in the 236. So it, on one hand here, the appellees are saying it was already there, but on the other hand, acknowledging that the standard setting body said it's not there, we need to change it because there is this problem that LG had identified and ultimately reached consensus where Samsung, ZTE, and HTC voted to approve the change. But yet they come in now saying no change was ever needed, it was already disclosed there. And it wasn't. Because the two conditions in the prior art standard.
What they said was there was a technical flaw that they corrected.
It's a problem. You know, what happened is when you get errant messages come in that aren't expected between these two, the device and the base station, the system has to restart. And every time it restarts, it's more delay, and you're trying to improve the speed and efficiency of the system here. And that's what LG had invented, was said, under the prior version of 3.2.1, that standard doesn't have the right checks. Its conditions that are disclosed is if there's an ongoing random access procedure, and if there's data stored in the message 3 buffer, then you send stored message 3. But as you see in figure 8 of the patent, which I think is a good graphical illustration of the problem, which is APX 159, you can have an errant message coming. And in, when that happens, the wrong data is sent. And that's why under the board's construction that it adopted, it said you can only transmit stored message 3 data when those two conditions are true. The fact is the 3.2.1 specification is the only disclosure that the appellees cite and the board relied on that actually talks about conditions, what to look at to determine what data should be sent. And on the face of the document, the conditions of the claim are not there. And so the board improperly then expanded the disclosure to say, well, ongoing random access procedure is the same as receiving uplink grant on the random access file. That's false. They are not the same. There are, in fact, two conditions. The standard was changed to make that correction. And, in fact, if you look at APX 1388, which is the 3.2.1 specification at issue, if you look at 5.4.1, it talks about what the device will do upon receipt of an uplink grant. In there, it says the uplink grant comes on the random access response, or if it comes on a PDCCH, which is another different message, the same action will occur. Namely, you will indicate that uplink grant was received for that time interval. And so again, that's all illustrating the problem here. The prior art didn't care where the uplink grant came from. And so it would not, there are no disclosures that the stored message 3 buffer will only be sent when the uplink grant is on the random access response and there's stored message 3 data.
Okay, this is a really complicated issue on the complex, on the technology.
Yep.
But in this case, on the process issue, you had no expert, or your expert was given no weight, and the other side did have an expert, right? And your challenge in blue brief seems to talk about the board's exclusion of the declaration by your only expert witness. But it wasn't really an exclusion, right? The board didn't exclude the declaration. They just said they were not going to give it any weight because it was not sworn.
And they said that you acknowledge that your expert's declaration was defective. But you took no steps to cure it.
Well, several parts to that, those questions that I'll try to attempt to all. First of all, this court doesn't need to reach that issue because there's just a complete lack of evidence to support the board's decision. And it's the appellee's burden to come forward with that evidence. And the evidence that they have come forward with isn't sufficient. Nevertheless, if this court was to remand the case for any reason down, the court should remand for the consideration of our expert's declaration. Well, yes, if it was defective, there are a couple things. One, there is no regulation for us, for Evolve Wireless, to have fixed the problem. The board never granted any such relief, and there are no regulations for it.
I don't know the regulations word by word, but there are regulations that require that the declaration submitted somehow be sworn, right?
There are regulations on that, but there are no regulations about how to fix the issue once it was raised. What should have happened was the defendants raised the objection, then there is a regulation to allow us to supplement where we would have done it. And I think that we need to just step back and keep in mind
the burden is on them. When yours is sufficient, I mean, they did call you out on the reply, so you did have an opportunity to cure, right?
Well, there's no mechanism after the reply. Of course, regulations don't allow us to file a surreply.
There is such a thing as creative civil procedure. Did you try making a motion?
We did not, Your Honor. But I think it was important for the court to keep in mind here, this is really form over substance here. First of all, 2 days before the deposition of our expert was to occur in these PTAP seats, the appellees pulled the deposition. Likely because they know once they took his deposition under oath, this issue would go away. two in the concurrent.
Well, yeah, it's their prerogative. It's not, you call it form over substance. We call it litigation.
And not necessarily, because there's plenty of law that says that a declarant can't contravene their own declaration in a deposition.
Well, he was not going to testify differently than testify wholly consistent with it. And also note, in the concurrent district court litigation with the same appellees, this
argument. How do we know that? I mean, that's the whole point of making him swear to his declaration rather than just submit it. It's saying that he agrees in it and he thinks it's true and he's going to be bound by that. Without swearing to it, he could have come to his deposition and said something completely different. I know you say he's not going to do it, but we have no idea. And the board has no idea whether he actually stands behind those statements. That's the whole point of swearing behind it.
I understand. I also just want to note, as I told the board, he had filed similar, if not substantially the same opinions in the concurrent district court litigation, all under oath. They took his deposition on that, gave the same testimony. So, again, I really think that this issue, again, the court doesn't need to reach it because I think the evidence is not sufficient to support the board's decision. But if it was, this should be a decision where we are allowed to get this case remanded.
Even though you didn't make any attempt to correct it once it was pointed out to you.
Again, there was nothing for us to do other than to ask the court for permission, but there wasn't a regulation.
That's always how you ask to fix mistakes. Things like this. There's not something out there that is a rule that says, here's what you do to fix mistakes. You just ask.
Well, there is regulations on motions to supplement, which is what I was getting at. That would be.
Well, that's not a supplement. It's correcting your mistake and your failure to have him swear. And even if it was considered that, you should have still filed a motion for leave to do it.
Understood, Your Honor. So if I can move on, though, to the Kidazoe application, because I only have a limited time.
I have one. Further, and that is, you raised these constitutional challenges in this case, and you've had numerous issues involving constitutional challenges, and the other side filed, as it should have done, 28 J letters about our recent cases that arguably have resolved those issues. Do you agree those issues are gone and withdrawn from this case?
Well, I understand under the precedent that this panel is bound to follow those prior decisions, and so at this time we're not asking the panel to go contrary to the case law.
And you understand that therefore this case is consumed, it is under the umbrella of what we've already decided in other cases, which came after the briefing, and in fairness to you, right?
Yeah, I understood, Your Honor, and if we decide at some point to move on that issue, perhaps then we would exercise our right to have the issue decided that way under the precedent of the court, but at this time. We think those decisions hold.
Before you walk away entirely from that area, at page 20 of the gray brief, you say the PTAB wrongly excluded your defective declaration because, quote, giving no evidentiary weight to filed exhibits is equivalent to excluding the evidence. You didn't cite any legal authority for that. Do you have any?
No, we don't, Your Honor, but I think the effect of it was the same as exclusion. I think, what you call it, we don't think of the ultimate matter of how it came to be.
So supposing they had let it in, and they said, we don't believe a word in this, that would be the same as exclusion, too, is what you're saying.
Well, because then you would have at least considered it, but
said they did consider it.
Well, they said they weren't going to give it any weight, which we would argue is the same as if it had not even been in the record.
Let me move you onto a different subject, and that is on page 61, same area, but on page 61 of the blue brief, you say the PTAB's actions concerning that declaration, quote, were intended to preclude consideration of a full record so that the PTAB could try to end the proceedings by simply adopting ZTE's and Apple's argument. So that's a pretty serious charge. What proof do you have of that intent?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm just trying to find the exact letter. Sure. You said page 61 of the
61 of the blue brief.
Blue brief. So again, by not giving any consideration to evidence that was in the record to have a full and fair record for them to decide the facts and just simply having one side only, that's how it therefore results in the PDAP only looking at the one side, not having a full and fair record for each side issue.
But you understand that Judge Wallach, was just, you say the board's actions were intended to preclude reconsideration. It's one thing to say the board's actions here resulted in, you know, our not having the ability to have this considered. But you're ascribing kind of a intent to the board. We want to get rid of this case. We want to go for petitioners. So we're going to not consider the full record, and we want to just get this over with. That's the essence of what I read the sentence as saying.
Right.
Wrong?
Right. Well, that was not the intent of the statement. The intent of the statement was more that because the board didn't offer any opportunity for us to fix the issue, it then ultimately made a decision based on an incomplete.
Words matter, counsel. That's not a statement. It's an accusation.
Well, the result of them not including ours is that all that was left was petitioner's side.
What you did is an accusation of judicial misconduct.
That is not what we were stating there. What we were just again stating was that what the board ultimately then ends up with is just a one side of the story. Now, if I could just move on to Kid Zoe really quick, I'm running.
Okay, you're out of your time. If you want to take an extra minute, if you have an additional point to make, I assume, on the threshold issue.
Yeah, so just on Kid Zoe, the main issue again is that, like the other evidence, only talks about the sending of message three. It doesn't talk about what data is in the message three or what conditions were used to look at what data put in message three. So Kid Zoe, like section 300, doesn't disclose the claim invention, and again, the board had improperly expand the disclosure that was in Kid Zoe to reach its ultimate decision. So for those reasons, we would submit that all of the final written decisions lack any evidence in support, much less even substantial evidence.
Thank you. Will we stir a couple minutes of rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Brooks, okay, we've got a confusing situation of three people splitting their time, which is not our favorite thing. So why don't you tell us who's going to argue what, so we'll know what to ask.
Your Honor, why don't you just argue the whole thing?
I don't think Mr. McMahon would be very happy with that. I'm only going to argue Kid Zoe, and very, very briefly, since there were very little questions about Kid Zoe. So
let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that Claim 1 is represented?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. Thank you.
So let's begin with what I think, because there was a pivot between the blue brief and the reply brief. In the blue brief, one of the arguments was that Kid Zoe, while it taught this transmission of message 3 pursuant to an uplink grant coming in an RAR, random access response message, that it didn't specifically say that that message 3 came from the data stored in the message 3 buffer. Just to address that very quickly and very clearly, if you the court looks at page 35 of the blue brief, it is conceded that the prior art taught that the message 3 buffer is the source of the content of the transmission in message 3 that is responsive to a random access request message which contains an uplink grant. So to say we didn't show it when they conceded it in the blue brief, I think is then a non-argument. The more important argument, the bigger argument, is that Kid Zoe apparently doesn't send message 3 buffer data, that there's no exclusion in Kid Zoe preventing message 3 buffer data from being sent in response to a non-random access response message. Well, first of all, we don't have to. Under AC Tech and Sud Chemi cases, you do not have to, the prior doesn't have to have an explicit statement of the exclusion. Instead, what we have here at multiple places in Kid Zoe is that the only time message 3 is sent is only when there is an uplink grant sent in a random access response message. That's it. There are no other circumstances in which it is sent, and therefore, implicitly, it is only if the random access response message contains the uplink grant. Of course, we are looking at a substantial evidence standard, and the Kid Zoe reference was described through the view of one of skill in the art by Dr. Wells, which the PTAB found both credible and reasonable.
And as we noted, there was no expert testimony on the other side.
Correct, Your Honor. And so that takes it out of the realm of the Facebook case, which is a non-precedential case that appellant is relying on, because in Facebook, They said there was no expert testimony in support of the negative limitation being taught in the prior art. Here we have the opposite. We have expert testimony saying it's implicit in the prior art and no expert testimony to the contrary. Last, we come to that second transmitting limitation about when new data is allowed to be sent. In the blue brief, it appeared that the appellant was arguing that the prior art didn't teach that new data was sent only if the uplink grant was in a non-random access response message. They pivoted in the reply brief, and now they seem to concede that the prior art does in fact teach that. And I think they have to, because if you look at Appendix 1706, specifically the summary zone, column 13, lines 15 through 20, it says that the UL grant is included in the content resolution message. That's message 4. And therefore, that is not the random access response message. So that's what Kitazoe teaches. So what happens in the reply brief is that they pivot and now say that we have to show that this new data is sent during the random access procedure, when in fact, random access procedure and the word during are nowhere in the claim. So this is a new argument on their part. It's really a claim construction argument that has been waived and that we do not need to address. And unless the court has any other questions, I will cede the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Judge Wallach, we agree. Claim one is representative. I just wanted to walk through, I'm Charles McMahon on behalf of ZTE, HTC, and Samsung in connection with the underlying 757 and 1345 proceedings addressing the 300 and 321 references. Just walk through them very briefly and show that they do present substantial evidence supporting the board's conclusion. First point is the 321 reference itself, which shows, and this is at Appendix 1388, the same page that Mr. Schultz pointed to, at the bottom of the page there's an if then else structure. And the first part of that shows that you transmit message 3 if you're in a random access procedure and there is data in the message 3 buffer. The second part says else you transmit new data. Now, patent owner suggests that the first part of that is not enough because it says random access procedure as opposed to responding to a random access message. That is a piece of this particular standard document that was later clarified. However, this document did not stand on its own, nor did we present it on its own in support of the invalidity ground. We presented it in combination with the 300 reference. The 300 reference at Appendix 1292 shows a figure which has probably become quite familiar to the court. It's a four back and forth of four messages, and that is the random access procedure. Message one is sent by the user equipment, which then waits for message 2, which is the random access response, and then, and only then, does the user equipment send message 3. That is clear from both the figure in the 300 reference as well as the text that bridges pages Appendix 1292 and 1293, demonstrating that it was known to those in the art in Working Group 2 at the time, and it was documented in the 300 reference that you only send message 3 if you've received message 2. And that's what this whole piece is about, knowing when to send message 3 and not sending message 3 when you're not supposed to. Yes?
I asked your opposing counsel about it's fair to say the statement in the red briefs that two individuals within 3 hours of each other both sent substantially, they weren't exact, but substantially similar suggestions for corrections to the standard. And I've worked with those kinds of groups before, and it is sort of groupthink kind of thing. There wasn't anything I could find in the record that showed me what was going on. Is there something that shows those were independent, or were they? Do you believe they were independent?
I believe they were independent, Your Honor, and this is what I can say. Substantively, they were identical in what they attempted to accomplish. But the expression of the idea was very different between the two. So if you compare Appendix 3008 to 3009, that's the Qualcomm submission.
Right.
And if you look at the text, it's redlined on those pages, what Qualcomm was proposing to change, What Qualcomm proposed was different in expression and text than what LG proposed, and that's at Appendix 3013 to 3014.
Right.
So
I know they were different, yeah.
The independence of expression, they were both expressing the same idea, but they went at it different ways, which to me, you know, if Qualcomm were trying to do a Me Too of what LG did, you'd think that they would have said, we support LG, or at least would have submitted exactly the same text. That's not what happened here. So it seems to me from the record that they did come up with the same idea independently, and they submitted functionally the same idea with slightly different expression. I'd also note that the board didn't rely exclusively. I'd note two things. First of all, this is simultaneous development. This is just reaffirming the underlying obviousness case, which of course is based on substantial evidence of the 300 and 321 references. Those two stand alone, even without the simultaneous development evidence. But the board did say simultaneous development reinforces our otherwise robust view of obviousness. And they pointed not only to the Qualcomm proposal, which came after the filing date of the patent application, they also pointed to another submission earlier from Philips and NXP Semiconductor, which also showed a logic tree where message 3 is only sent in response to message 2. Again, reinforces the substantial evidence that the board's conclusion. That NXP document is discussed in the final written decision at pages 28 to 29, and the submission itself is at Appendix 3001.
That's a useful and good, solid answer. Thank you.
I'd be happy to address any other questions the court may have. Otherwise, I yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm also going to be extremely short. Dennis Van on behalf of the United States on the constitutional issues. As this court has recognized, and as everybody in this room seems to agree.
You guys thought we were wrong?
No, I'm not. This court's decisions, including Chief Judge Russ's decision and Celgene, are absolutely correct, and both Celgene and Arthrex foreclose the entirety of the constitutional challenges here. We would just urge the court to express or state what constitutional challenges were raised in this case, and that they're foreclosed by precedent of the circuit. Thank you.
Will we store 2 minutes of rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel for appellees did not come up and point to exact, specific disclosures in the references for the claim invention. I heard words of implicit and other words along the same lines. There was no disclosure where you've got reference A has element one, reference B's got element two, you put them together, you have the claim invention. It's not there. Well, again, what counsel for ZTE said, it's all about sending message 3. That's not the claim invention. Claim invention is not about just sending message 3. It's about the data that is in message 3. And again, you did not hear from them showing that what conditions, the claim conditions, were the ones considered in the prior art in order to send the right message 3 data at the right time. As to the Kitazoe argument, I would just note for the court, only when was the construction that the board adopted, only when has to have meaning. And only when means you can only send stored message 3 data when these conditions are true. Kitazoe lacks any disclosure. And the only disclosure they then rely on is the 321 specification, which I talked about earlier, also discloses different conditions. That is just a prime example of a lack of any evidence, much less substantial evidence, of the claimed invention in the references. So for those reasons, again, we would reiterate that there is no evidence, much less substantial evidence, to support the board's findings in all the proceedings. As to the NXP reference, NXP reference has nothing to do with when to send what data in message 3. All it just says is there's a lot of times when message 3 can happen to be sent. That's it. That's not relevant to the issue here. So that doesn't answer the question, Judge Wallach, that you posed of is there evidence of simultaneous invention. There's not. And to be clear, it's undisputed, LG came first. They didn't come second, they were first.
Did any people saw the idea and said, that's a great idea, let's move forward with it? With that, if there are no further questions, I will submit the case.
Thank you. And we thank all sides, and the case is submitted. And let me just say what I should have said at the outset, which is that our court does this typically once a year, sometimes twice a year. And we travel to different venues, which we feel is our obligation because we're a national court. But we bring our cases with us. So our being successful in being able to do this depends on the cooperation of counsel, traveling in many cases outside of your space. We're moving from Washington. Sometimes it ends up being more convenient, which is a nice coincidence. But we thank all the parties here today for their cooperation. Yes, sir.
This is a personal note. Ms. Brooks, I know Mr. Countryman was on the brief, and you have all of our entire court's condolences.
Thank you very
and
much.
And we knew him and really respected his talent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.